and a woman in the one flesh relationship that God established all the way back in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. Indeed, we learn from Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 21 that God always approves of this relationship in which a husband and a wife meet each other's sexual needs, their physical needs, in marriage. And again, Proverbs 5 provides a wonderful commentary on what we also discover in the Song of Solomon. Indeed, Paul also addresses the importance of the sexual component of marriage in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and indeed says that God says to a man, give your body as a gift to your wife, and he says to a wife, give your body back to your husband. Your body no longer belongs exclusively to you, but it now also belongs to your mate as well. If one were to try to summarize what the Bible has to say about the importance and the purpose of sex within marriage, I think at least six things could be noted by way of summary as we prepare to look at these verses. Let me note them quickly and even give you a scripture reference as well. Number one, sex includes the purpose of knowledge. We find that in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 1. Secondly, intimate oneness. We find this in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. Number three, comfort. And we find this in the story of Isaac and Rebekah in Genesis chapter 24 and verse 67. Fourthly, it is for the purpose of procreation, or the creation of new life, Genesis chapter 1 and verse 28. Fifthly, as we are learning, I think, quite clearly from the Song of Solomon, God also gave us sex for play and for pleasure. And we're going to see that developed, I think, quite beautifully tonight in chapter 4. And then number six, God also gave us sex within marriage to avoid temptation. Indeed, a husband is commanded to find satisfaction and joy in his wife. And he is to concern himself with her and her only, and her unique and special needs. But by the same token, a wife is also to take on certain responsibilities sexually within the marriage relationship, such as availability, 1 Corinthians 7, 3 through 5, preparation and planning. We'll see that tonight in Song of Solomon 4, verses 9 and following. Interest and sensitivity to unique masculine needs. And so the feeling of oneness, which is experienced by a husband and wife in the physical sexual union, is something that God says is a good thing. And in one sense, it is to be somewhat of a foretaste, somewhat of an inkling of the ultimate oneness that we experience in new birth when the Holy Spirit births us into the kingdom of God. This indeed, the sexual relationship within marriage, is the closest thing this side of heaven to the intimacy and the oneness that we should experience when we are converted and when we are born again. And so we discover in the Song of Solomon that there is beauty and there is blessing in the Christian bedroom, and that God looks down from heaven and says, I am pleased. In chapter 5 and verse 1, we will see that he says, drink and drink deeply of the joy of sex in marriage. Now, when we come to chapter 4, we have come to the wedding night. Last week we saw the wedding with its grand processional and the actual coming to the home of the groom and the joy that was shared by the friends of the groom and the bride. And all of that was brought to a climax with the gift of his mother, a crown on the day of his rejoicing in chapter 3. But now in chapter 4, and in many ways chapter 4 serves as the apex of the book. It is at the very center of the book, especially the latter verses. You have come to the wedding night, and you've come to the time when finally they have the opportunity to consummate the marriage that God has indeed blessed and that God has ordained. And so, what is it that the Bible would teach us this evening from these verses about the beauty and the blessings of the Christian bedroom? I have five ideas I will share with you this evening. Number one, the Christian bedroom, let it be a place of satisfying attractiveness. Chapter 4, verse 1 through verse 7. Solomon writes, behold, you are fair or beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. In what way? Well, you have dove's eyes behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep which have come up from the washing, every one of which bears twins, and none is barren among them. Your lips are like a strand of scarlet, and your mouth is altogether lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like a piece of pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory on which hang 1,000 small shields, all shields of mighty men. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. You are fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. Basically, verses 1 through 7 constitute a song of admiration, a hymn of admiration from the groom to his bride. The time has come for them to consummate the marriage, though that will not actually take place until verse 16 of this text. And so all that is taking place before verse 16 is leading up to that union and leading up to that event. Solomon was a smart man. Solomon knew, as Willard Harley has well said, that you must cultivate an environment of affection. And when you cultivate an environment of affection, sexual union will take place more often and with greater satisfaction. In other words, a man must understand there are some essential preliminaries before the main event. Unfortunately, far too many men do not understand this. And so once being aroused sexually, they become like a predator. And it's not surprising that often their bride feels like the prey. And therefore, she does not feel that this relationship is something that is of the heart, but rather is nothing more than animal lust at its most basic level. Now, acknowledging the fact that our sexual passions can indeed flame and be aroused greatly, a wise man will still understand how important it is to approach his wife in a kind and gracious and gentle way. And the fact of the matter is this: Solomon clearly understood what is indeed the most important sex organ we have, and surprise, surprise, it is between your ears, it is your mind. That is the most important sexual organ, sexual aspect of your being that you have. For it really starts here before it moves elsewhere. And so Solomon, understanding that getting to the mind, getting to the heart of the Shulamite woman, of his bride, he should make his way first of all through her ear. And so what does Solomon do? But he chooses very carefully very precious words in this text that speaks of his love and speaks of his concern for her on the wedding night. So what do we see? Two things. Number one, men, meet your wife's need for verbal support. Meet your wife's need for verbal support. She is a verbal animal. God made her that way, and words have a way of speaking to her mind and her heart that cannot be accomplished in any other way. You see this very clearly in verse 1 and verse 7. He says, "Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful." Again, verse 7. "You are altogether beautiful, my love, and there is no spot in you." Three times, both at the beginning and the end of this song, Solomon says to Shulamite, "You're beautiful." Twice he calls her his love or his darling. And finally there in verse 7 he says, "There is no flaw in you." At least from his perspective, when he looked at her, he said, "I see an absolutely perfect woman." And so he speaks to her in a way that speaks directly to her heart. We have discovered that many men fail in the area of intimacy because they don't understand just how important words are to a woman. In Psychology Today, in 1983, it was noted that women are more likely to be disappointed with marriage than men, especially in the context of romance. Why? I quote, "In marriage, women talk. And they want verbal responsiveness of the kind that they have had with other women. But their men are often silent partners, unable to respond in kind. And so a man must understand that words, gentle, kind, gracious, affirming words, are something that a wife will find romantic, and it will help cultivate that romance and that affectionate atmosphere. So first of all, men, you must meet your wife's need for verbal support. But now secondly, ladies or women, you must meet your husband's need for visual stimulation. And it is not by accident that beginning there in verse 1 and going through verse 5, you have a remarkably detailed analysis or description of the Shulamite woman of Solomon's bride on their wedding night. In other words, if a woman is a creature of the ear, it is absolutely certain that a man is a creature of the eye. She may be moved by what she hears, but he is certainly moved by what he sees. And so what does he do? He will in these verses praise no less than 8 different parts of his wife's body. Now let me add, this would continue to meet her need for verbal support, especially as we begin to unlock the imagery here. But it also tells us something about how visually oriented men are when it comes to sex. And ladies, let me just say something to you before I move on. When we look at what Solomon does here in chapter 4 and what he will do again later in a few chapters, it's very clear that at least on the wedding night, this woman did not have on flannel or burlap or sweats. Okay? No flannel, no sweats, no burlap. The best I can come up with was she had a veil over her eyes, and that was about it. And so she understood where Solomon was coming from, just as I think he understood where she was coming from. And so she knew that she should present herself in a way that he would like. And indeed, I think he would have said to us, I not only liked it, I loved what I saw. Well, let's very quickly then walk through these. He says, first of all, there in verse 1, behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. You have eyes like a dove behind your veil. The veil was still hiding her eyes, her face in some sense. I think this would have enhanced her beauty, as both he can see her, but some things are still mysteriously hidden. We have seen the idea of the eyes of a dove previously in chapter 1 and verse 15, chapter 2 verse 14, and we will see it again in chapter 5 and verse 2. Basically, having eyes like a dove speaks of her tenderness, speaks of her gentleness, it speaks of her purity and the peace that she conveys, even the idea of innocence. And what I would simply say is this, outside of our mouths, we have learned, I think, in this book that the most effective device we have for communicating after that is our eyes. And by the way she looked at him, she expressed her love and her longing for him. He also says there in verse 1, your hair is like a flock of goats going down from Mount Gilead. Now, guys, if you go home tonight and tell your wife that she has eyes like a dove, she might respond in somewhat of a positive nature. On the other hand, if you say she's got hair like a billy goat, don't be surprised if you get punched out and kicked out of your bedroom. Now, guys, what we need to do here is unlock the Near Eastern imagery, and once we do that, we will discover that actually what he has done here has praised her in a very marvelous way. Mount Gilead was known for having areas where goats would graze, and if you've ever been to Israel, when you see a flock of black goats, and that's what is in view here, as they're on the mountainside, and as you get some distance from them, if they're either going up, but more likely going down as they make their way down to be watered, they flow back and forth, and it is a very lovely sight. It's a very beautiful sight. Now, what I think he's saying is this. During the wedding ceremony, she had her hair up, but now that they have stepped into the privacy of the bedroom, she has let her hair down, and now it has fallen down around her neck and around her shoulders and her wavy black locks. He indeed finds very enticing. I have to this day never met a man that says, you know, I just wish my wife would cut all of her hair off. I just wish she would have a buzz and just keep it nice and short. I've never met such a man. But I've met thousands of men who say, you know, long, beautiful, wavy hair just has something that speaks to my heart, and indeed I find it very attractive, especially when it is my wife. And so Solomon is basically saying to her, your eyes communicate your love, but your hair also communicates to me that you are ready for me, that you want me to come to you. You're making yourself ready by letting your long, lovely black locks down that I might be able to come to you. Now verse 2, your teeth are like a flock of shorn sheep, which have come up from the washing, and every one of which bears twins, and none of them is barren. You say, Danny, what all is that saying? Oh, I can summarize it like this. Number one, her teeth were white, not yellow. And number two, she wasn't missing any of them. In other words, she didn't come up with one missing right here, and you go grin with a, you know, I started to get a black pea and put it up here, but I thought that might be excessive. And so, but what he's saying is, look, they're all clean, they're all white, and they're all there. None of them is missing. Now, some people have rightly said, don't just stop there, because he is not just talking about her teeth. Look at verse 3. Your lips are also like a strand of scarlet, and your mouth is lovely. Now, here's a question that has to be raised, because he does have, I think, some very interesting figures here. Is he saying that she is only beautiful physically with her mouth and teeth? Is he saying she is only beautiful with the words that she speaks? Or is he saying both? Is he saying, I find not only you to be physically attractive when I look at your mouth, but I also find you personally attractive by the way you speak to me? And personally, I think we don't have to go for an either-or answer. We can go for a both-and answer. Indeed, I like what Snaith said in his commentary, and I quote, her mouth, it is a fertile oasis with lovely words flowing out of it, not to mention possible heavy, wet kissing. Her lips and her words both are prizes of pleasure. And I think he hits it exactly correctly. So he says there, your teeth, your lips. But then he says in the latter part of verse 3, your temples behind your veil, well, they are like a piece of pomegranate. He is comparing her temples here, her face, her cheeks, to halves of pomegranates. Well, pomegranates, number one, are red. So I think he is speaking of the fact that her face is flushed. I think it means that she is alive, that she is anticipating what is about to occur. Furthermore, we know that having flushed cheeks would speak of desire. Having cheeks like pomegranates would speak of their sweetness. And so Solomon is saying both to the sight and to the taste, I find your face and your mouth and your lips all together attractive. But then he says something else rather interesting in verse 4. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built for an armory on which hang 1,000 small shields, all shields of mighty men. Now, what is he saying here? But I think this. This is not a woman that is walking around cowed over, but rather she carries herself upright. She carries herself in a tall, graceful, stately kind of a way. Another, in thinking about this, Dwayne Garrett, a Southern Baptist, says, and I quote, the image conveys a sense of unassailable strength. No man could conquer her, and her suitor, her husband, is awed by the dignity she carries. Her love is a gift. No man could have ever plundered her. And I think by the way she carries herself then, she is indeed saying, I have indeed chosen as an act of my will to give myself to only one man, and that one man is you. Well, verse 5, your two breasts are like fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. And therefore, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. Very clearly, verses 5 and 6 draw attention to the breast of the Shulamite woman. By the description that he uses, he is saying they are soft and attractive. They are tender and they are delicate. Indeed, I cannot resist but wanting to reach out and touch them and caress them. I think it's also very clear there in verse 6 that he still has them in mind. For when he says, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh, I really think he's saying to one of your breasts. And then when he says, secondly, to the hill of frankincense, I think he is saying to the other breast. Now, both of these spices were expensive. Both of these spices were used as perfume for the body and also for the marriage bed. In fact, in Proverbs 7:17, we discover, among other things, that myrrh was used by the harlot to perfume her bed to attract adulterous relationships. And so here she is using the things that indeed should attract a man, but only her man unto herself. And so Solomon is so enraptured. He is so carried away by her beauty, by her smell, by all that she presents before him, that he basically says in verse 6, all night long I want to be with you. All night long I want to be involved in lovemaking with you until the day breaks and the shadows flee away. I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. Now, let me say this before we move on. Interestingly, having read these verses, not a one of us in this auditorium tonight really knows what Shulamite looked like. We don't. Given the description you have in verses 1 through 6, you couldn't draw a composite of her. You couldn't draw a picture of her. But you know what you do know? You do know this. In Solomon's eyes, she was irresistible. In Solomon's eyes, she was absolutely gorgeous and the most beautiful woman that he had ever seen. And guys, I want to tell you something. It is God's design in marriage that you look at one woman and one woman only in that kind of a way, and that that woman is your wife. And it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks. To her, and she knows this, to her and for her, you would say there is indeed no woman on the planet more attractive, more beautiful, more enticing, more desirable than are you. Let your bedroom be a place of satisfying attractiveness. Now, secondly, let it also be a place of sensual anticipation. Look with me there at verse 8. Solomon continues, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, my bride, with me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana, from the top of Senir and Hermon, from the lion's dens and from the mountains of the leopards. You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my spouse. How much better than wine is your love and the scent of your perfume than all spices. Your lips, oh my spouse, they drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments, it is like the fragrance of Lebanon. I recently discovered, by the way, that apparently human beings are the only creatures on the planet who see sex as fun, except for dolphins and pygmy chimps. Now, I don't know what to make of that, okay? I don't intend to interview any dolphins or any pygmy chimps to find out exactly what their perspective is, but I just found it interesting that when we look at everybody else, it's just sort of for the purpose of procreation, yet when we've observed dolphins and pygmy chimps, there seems to be something more to it than that. But when we look at humans, we do indeed understand that there's far more to this sex thing than simply procreation, than propagating the species. We think about it a lot. We talk about it a bunch. And we give it time and attention in a way that we hardly give anything else. Indeed, if for some reason we find this area not to be everything that we think it ought to be, we'll try to find help. And recently, as I was just surveying, if you just pick up normal, regular stuff, I'm not talking about stuff that you might not normally see. I mean, just walk into any kind of grocery store and just kind of check out what's out there for everybody to see. You find things like this in American magazines like Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report. You can order some videos by Dr. Sandra Scantling entitled Ordinary Couples, Extraordinary Sex. The sex education videos that increase sexual pleasure for both partners. Or if that's not good enough, I got a list of seminars that I can send you. One's entitled Getting the Love You Want. Another's entitled Resexing Marriage. Another one's called Resurrecting Sex, The Passionate Marriage Approach. Another one, Marital Sex as It Ought to Be, and perhaps my favorite, Hot Monogamy. Now, folks, that's all out there, and it's in every corner of every city, and if you find that you're just struggling in this area, you can go to these various seminars, or you can buy these various magazines, or even better than that, there's now a drug. In fact, I shouldn't share this, but today, I wasn't quite sure how to pronounce this word, so being at Southern Seminary, who would I go to ask how to pronounce the word? Dr. Moeller. So I said, Dr. Moeller, how do you pronounce this word? P-H-E-R-O-M-O-N-E-S. He turned blood red and said, why do you want to know how to pronounce it? I said, because I'm going to share it tonight at the Highview Baptist Church when I'm preaching on Song of Solomon. And I mean, I think his heart skipped a beat. And he just said, I don't want to talk about it anymore. And he turned around and walked away. Well, I'm going to talk about it anyway, and y'all can tell him I did. That thing I just spelled is called a pheromone. Like a pheromone. Now listen to this. In 1999, many major magazines ran stories about the sensual power of a chemical called pheromones that, quote, will boost your sex appeal and change your social and sex life forever. Science and nature's secret sexual weapon. And then here's how it's described. This high-octane potion can be ordered via a 1-888 number. And I got it if you want it, but I didn't put it in here. For $34.95 a bottle, plus $3 shipping and handling, regardless of how many bottles you order. So if you order 50 bottles, it's only still going to cost you just $3 one time. And, listen to this now, it comes with an unconditional satisfaction guarantee. Quote, if you do not find you are meeting and dating and scoring with more people of the opposite sex after 30 days, simply return the unused portion for a full refund, no questions asked. Now, I haven't done any survey work to see how well the product's doing, and I haven't bought any stock in it. I do say this, folks. I look at these kind of things, and part of me just wants to chuckle and laugh. And then part of me wants to just weep and grieve, because it is an evidence of the fact that though we talk about it, think about it, sing about it, we don't understand it. We really haven't yet got it when it comes to understanding sex as God intended. And the fact of the matter is, the data's pretty clear. Going our own way has not been a pretty sight. So maybe it might be wise, again, simply let God be our instructor and our guide, and let Him tell us how it is that we ought to pursue this wonderful area of marriage. Well, He said, first of all, let your bedroom be a place of satisfying attractiveness. But then secondly, let it be a place of sensual anticipation. Now, how do we do that? Well, two ideas here. Number one, invite your mate to come to you. And number two, indicate how your mate captivates you. Look at it with me there in verse 8. He says, come with me from Lebanon, my spouse, my bride. He will call her this no less than five times in this text. And, of course, he refers to her homeland where she had grown up in the northern part of Israel. Come, my spouse, from Lebanon. Come from the tops of Amana, from the top of Senir and Hermon. And now here's what's important. From the lion's dens and from the mountains of the lepers. Now, what is he doing? Basically, I think he's using some imagery here that says, in essence, I know that you're still a little nervous. I know that giving yourself to me in marriage is something unknown. You've never been down this road before, and I understand that you're anxious. I understand that there may be questions going through your mind. And so notice what he does. He doesn't demand, come here, but he requests. He doesn't order her. He invites her to leave her fears, to leave her anxieties, to leave home, and come to him. Now, understand what he's done before he asked her to do this. He has told her, I think you're the most beautiful woman on the planet. I don't think anybody I've ever seen compares to you. Both in looks and character, no woman is your equal. He does all of that before he invites her to leave and come to be with him. So invite your mate to come to you, but invite them in the right way. Again, his gentleness, his care, the tenderness this man shows this woman is an absolutely marvelous example for every male on the planet to learn from. But then secondly, indicate how your mate captivates you. Words are still, in his judgment, not at a point where they are not needed again. And so in verse 9, he begins to say of her, "You have ravished my heart." It means to steal. You have stolen my heart. And then he says something very odd. My sister, my spouse. In the ancient Near East, to call someone your sister, like your bride, was a term of affection. We'll learn later that you could not in an outward way show physical affection towards your spouse. The only persons who could were family members. And so to call her his sister speaks of their friendship, speaks of an affection that he has for. It also says, in essence, I wish I could publicly show others how I feel about you. So you're my sister. You're my bride. You have ravished my heart. In case you didn't get it the first time, I'll say it again. You have ravished my heart. In what way have you ravished my heart? With one look of your eyes. With one link of your necklace. Just a glance of your eyes, and I'm undone. Just a twinkle of the necklace around your neck, and I am reduced. I am intoxicated. I am entrapped. I cannot escape the love that I find in you. He says in verse 10, how beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How good? Oh, much better than wine is your love, and the scent of your perfumes than all spices. Now, what do we know about wine? We know that it's sweet. We know that it's intoxicating. And he says, you take the best wine, it doesn't compare to you. Charles Spurgeon, of all people, wrote a commentary on the Song of Solomon. And in that, he says this about why is her love better than wine. Number one, it could be enjoyed without question. Number two, it would never turn sour. Number three, it would never produce ill effects. And number four, it produced a sacred exhilaration. And so he says of her, your love is better than wine, the scent of your perfume than all the spices. And then look at this. Your lips, O my spouse, they drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments, oh, it is like the fragrance of Lebanon. Verse 11 moves us into extremely sensual territory. It's very romantic. He says, your lips, they drip sweetness like the honeycomb, and honey and milk are under your tongue. Now, I don't need to go too far with this, but I'll just say this in passing. There are a lot of people that think a particular style of kissing was created in a country in Europe called France several years ago, some centuries back, but that's not true. But deep, wet, passionate kissing. Folks, you tell me what it means. Your lips, oh my spouse, they drip like the honeycomb. Honey and milk are where? Under your tongue. And the fragrance of your garments, it is like the fragrance of Lebanon. Now, folks, any way you want to talk about it, Solomon's talking about that which is passionate, that which is sensual, that which is meaningful, and yes, I really do think that which should be reserved only for a man and a woman within the bonds of marriage. So he says, let it be a place of sensual anticipation. But now number three, and let me hasten, let it also be a place of specific availability. Let me just note the two things we see here, and we'll tackle it quickly. Number one, God is pleased when we keep ourselves pure. And secondly, God is pleased when we give each other pleasure. Verse 12, he says three things. A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed. You see the three metaphors there? An enclosed garden, a shut up spring, and a fountain that is sealed. What is being said here is simply this. She was a virgin. She had maintained her sexual purity and fidelity until the night of her wedding. She's never known a man. She has saved herself for this night. And folks, just by way of reminder of something we all know, I have to this day never met a man or a woman that went into marriage as a virgin and said to me, you know, I regretted it. I regretted that I saved myself for marriage. I've never met such a person. But I've met many a person who says, if I could have anything back on my wedding night, I would have loved to have had back my virginity. Many a man and many a woman has expressed their own heartache in this area, similar to the way a young lady by the name of Monica expressed this to Josh McDowell some years ago. Dear Mr. McDowell, having premarital sex was the most horrifying experience of my life. It wasn't at all the emotionally satisfying experience the world deceived me into believing. I felt as if my insides were being exposed and my heart left unattended. I know God has forgiven me of this haunting sin, but I also know I can never have my virginity back. I dread the day I have to tell the man I truly love and wish to marry that he is not the only one, though I wish he were. I have stained my life, a stain that will never come out. Signed, Monica. Folks, we need to be reminded, and we need to remind our kids and our grandkids, God is pleased when we save ourselves for marriage. But secondly, God is also pleased when we give each other pleasure. Look at verse 13, 14, and 15. He again describes his bride, and he says, your plants are an orchard, a garden of pomegranates, pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard, and saffron, calamus, and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh, and aloes, with all the chief spices. What he is basically saying here is you're a fantasy garden. You are a lover's dream. You would never find a garden with all of these things located in one place. And yet Solomon says, I have, and I have found it in you. When I look at you, when I touch you, when I smell you, I find a dream garden unlike anything any man would ever find any place on the earth. And then because of that, look at how the metaphor now changes in verse 15. Yes, in verse 12, we have seen she saved herself, but now she is his. And so the metaphors change. You are a fountain of gardens, a well of, not an enclosed garden or an enclosed fountain. You're a well of living water and streams from Lebanon. In other words, Solomon says, yes, to other men, you were locked up, you were encircled, you were sealed, you were closed, but now that you belong to me, you are open, you are accessible, you are available. What you once held back from others, you now joyfully and freely and willingly give to me. How he praises her that she would save herself, first of all, and then how he praises her for how she gives herself to him. Let it be a place of specific availability. Number four, let it also be a place of sexual affection. Two things. Verse 16, encourage your mate to make love with you. Chapter 5, verse 1, encourage your mate after love with you. Verse 16, Shulamite speaks for the first time in the fourth chapter. She has been listening for 15 verses to what her husband was saying about her. Finally, she cannot take it anymore. She is so blessed, so overwhelmed, so confident, so safe, so secure that she can now say, awake, O north wind, and come, O south, blow upon my garden that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and let him eat its pleasant fruit. What do happy couples say about the intimate part of marriage, about sex? Well, Reader's Digest ran a story several years ago entitled, What Do Happy Couples Say About Sex? They had this caption, with a dash of surprise and a pinch of romance and a word or two at the right moment, love can be kept simmering even in the longest marriage. Well, if you look at the handout that you have this evening on the third page, I have synopsed that survey or that study for you, and I slightly adjusted it and added a couple of things that I thought might bring the list to a full and more complete rendition. Note it very quickly because I do think we just received some really good practical counsel here. Number one, they make sex a priority. It is important to them. Number two, they make time for sex. Number three, and boy, is this not true of Solomon and Shulamith, they stay emotionally intimate. Number four, they know how to touch and what works. Number five, they keep romance alive by meeting each other's needs. Number six, they keep their sexual anticipation alive. Number seven, they know how to play and foreplay, both in and out of bed. Number eight, they know how to talk to each other. Number nine, they remain lovers, and this is so important. I added this, they missed it in the article. They remain lovers and friends. Number 10, they maintain a sense of humor and know how to laugh. Number 11, they want to please the other. And number 12, they cherish each other as a sacred and precious gift of God. Well, it's very clear to me that Solomon and Shulamith want to fall into the happy couple category. And so we see here, first of all, an encouragement to your mate to make love with you. She who has been told twice before in chapter 2, verse 7, and chapter 3, verse 5, do not awaken love until the right time, now says the time is right. I am yours. Come and take me. Come and love me. North winds were strong winds. South winds were more gentle. And I do agree with what one commentator said. There is something to be learned here, gentlemen. Sometimes in lovemaking, your wife wants you to be very strong and passionate. Sometimes in lovemaking, your wife wants you to be very gentle and kind. Sometimes she wants both in the same experience, and sometimes she wants them separated out. That is the beauty and the just the mystery of a woman. And so she says, north winds, south winds, may they come. And she has been listening, hasn't she? Solomon has compared her to what? A garden. And so now how does she view herself? As this beautiful, ravenous, exotic fantasy garden. Come and blow up on my garden, blow up on my person, blow up on me in an intimate kind of a way. Come and blow up on my garden that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruit. Now again, one of the things I get from this text, folks, is simply this. These two people knew how to communicate. Let me remind all of us this evening, we know this, but we need to be reminded. Just because everything fits between a man and a woman doesn't mean the intimate part of marriage will be what God intended. It's not a mechanical union. It is a personal, spiritual, intimate union. And therefore, for it to be what God designed it to be, we must talk, we must listen, we must know and understand what it is that will speak to the needs of our heart and the needs of our own mate. Well, Solomon says here, he is told by the Shulamite woman, come and make love with me. And then look at what happens. He responds after the event in chapter 5, verse 1. I have come to... Now notice, she called it his garden in verse 16. He calls it my garden in verse 1 of chapter 5. In fact, interestingly, only one possessive pronoun is used in chapter 4, verses 1 through 16 by Solomon. Just one. In chapter 5, verse 1, there are nine. Nine. But again, gang, it didn't come at the front end in chapter 4. It came at the very end of chapter 5. I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey, and I have drunk my wine with my milk. And so Solomon here praises her, and he says, I have been ravished, I have been satisfied. That which you gave me, I came to, and I cannot even begin to express the joy and the blessing that it has been. So let it be a place of sexual affection. But fifthly, and probably in my mind, from some people's perspective, most interestingly, let it also be a place of spiritual approval. The last phrase of chapter 5 in verse 1 simply says this, eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. Now, this phrase has caused no small controversy in interpreting the Song of Solomon. Because the question that just screams at us is, who in the world is saying this? Who in the world is in there in the bedroom with Solomon and Shulamite and can say here, eat, friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, beloved ones? Well, some people have tried to argue that it is the friends, the chorus girls, the daughters of Jerusalem. But folks, I got news for you. They wouldn't have been allowed in there. Others have said, well, it's just their friends in general. But again, they wouldn't have been in there. Others have tried to say, well, it's the wind being personified again like it was in verse 16. But that really doesn't fit either. Toward couples today. Linda Dillo, Lorraine Pintus, in also commenting on this, says, yes, God is there. He sees, he is pleased with what he sees. He sees the passion. He hears the sighs of delight. He watches the lovers as they caress one another in the most intimate places. He is witness to the fleshly, earthly sighs, sounds, and smells. God desires for us to rejoice in our sensuousness, to give in to it. So sex and marriage enjoys very clearly divine approval. And secondly, spouses in marriage enjoy divine affection. Did you notice there, first of all, he calls them, eat, O friends. And then secondly, he says, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. God loves them, and he loves what he sees in the intimacy of marriage. How foreign that is to so many people. People think in God's eyes sex is a dirty word, a dirty idea. It is something we do simply to make babies and for nothing more than that. Yet nothing could be further from the truth when it comes to God's perspective on this wonderful, precious gift that he has given us. I doubt I've heard it said any better than by a woman named Beth who wrote, "Loving my husband can become an act of worship to God. As my husband and I lie together, satiated in the afterglow of sexual ecstasy, the most natural thing in the world is for me to offer thanksgiving to my God for the beauty, the glory of our sexual joy. I don't even think about what I'm doing. My heart just turns to the Lord and offers praise. Truly, his gift of sex is a wondrous thing." Now, I want to close tonight by doing something I always do in a marriage seminar. Since I got you here tonight, I'm going to do it to you guys. You find in the handout tonight a test that's on the last couple of pages entitled The Lover's Quotient Test. Now, the reason I do this is because some men need a little assistance in preparing a romantic environment. You just don't quite get it yet, and I've been working real hard over these number of weeks to try to get us there, and I'm still in the process of learning too. And so I've given you a test that I want you to go home tonight and take with your wife. Now, let me give a few instructions, and then I'll have us in a closing prayer, and we'll go home. Number one, don't take the results of this test too seriously. But number two, do take them seriously enough. You say, well, why are you saying that? Well, look at the bottom of the last page, and you'll see the scores that you're going to strive to obtain. And I think it'd be good for me just to give a word of explanation about what you'll be shooting for tonight. Now, you go home and take this test tonight, guys. You score between 200 and 360. You're a lover. Here's the description of you. Awesome. You're the man. You undoubtedly have one of the most satisfied wives in the country, and you're in the top 1%. If you make 150 to 200, to quote Andy Griffin, you're good. Way to go. Very few make this category. Your wife probably smiles a lot. Now, if you make 100 to 150, you're average. This husband is the norm and usually not very exciting as a lover. You're steady, but there are not many fireworks in the area of romance from your wife's perspective. 50 to 100, klutz. You're boring, and you can do better than this. And unfortunately, this is where most men tend to fall. And then God forbid that you get 0 to 50, because that then means you are the typical husband. Ouch, sad, sad, sad. And there's a huge difference between a typical husband and a lover. And please listen to this. The only reason your wife is still married to you is that she's a Christian. And she does have unusual capacity for unconditional acceptance of you. And there are some verses in the Bible that sustain her. Now, let me tell you a story. We go home. I gave this silly test a number of years ago in Lawton, Oklahoma. The next night, this very attractive and elegant lady came up to me. I guess she was in her late 40s or early 50s. But she was just a stunningly attractive and elegant woman. I later found out from her pastor, at least from his perspective, he said to me, "Danny, she is without any doubt the most godly woman I've ever known. She may be the most godly person I've ever met in all of my life. She is just the best of the best." Well, I think I know part of the reason why, because she came up to me and she said, "Last night, Dr. Aiken, my husband and I took your test." Well, I was somewhat taken back because it's very seldom that people volunteer the test scores of their husbands unless they want to just kind of, you know, give it to them. But I could tell by the way she was talking that this guy must have done fairly well. And so I said, "Well, how'd he do?" She said, "Oh, he did very well. He made a 270. Which, by the way, to this night, and that was 13 years ago, is still the best first-time score of any person I've ever known. No one's ever broken it the first time giving it a shot, all right? Well, y'all have discovered by now how playful I am, and so I looked at her and I said, "Well, I just have one question. Is he that good?" And she said, and I'll never forget it, "Yes, he is. I am quite certain that I am married to the most wonderful man in all the world." And she turned around and she graciously walked away. And when she said that, I have to tell you, the Lord spoke to my own heart that night, because when she said that, I stopped for a moment and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if someone were to walk up to Charlotte, my wife, and ask the simple question, "Is Danny that good?" With honesty and integrity, she could say, "Yes, he is. I am quite certain that I am married to the most wonderful man in all the world." Guys, I'll just tell you, this side of heaven, few things could be said about a husband that would be a greater honor than that. So take the test. Don't take it too seriously, but guys, do take it seriously enough, because if you will, you will find indeed that the beauty and the blessings of the Christian bedroom are wonderful. And in fact, I think you may discover that they are far more fantastic than you could ever hope or imagine. Let me close us in prayer. Heavenly Father, I know tonight we've talked about a very intimate part of our lives and our marriages, and I pray that I have done it in a way that was honoring to you and that in no way made it anything other than the beautiful, precious, wonderful gift that you have given to us. And I thank you how in the Song of Solomon it is so descriptive and yet beautifully descriptive, and how it does not in any way get dirty or cheap, but it speaks in most elegant terms about the gracious, marvelous, godly, good gift that we have in sex and marriage. And Lord, I would pray with all of my heart that every man here tonight would be a wonderful lover for his wife, and that every woman would be a wonderful lover for her husband, and that together each of us in our marriages would indeed find the joy and the blessing and the happiness and the ecstasy that you intended from the very beginning when you gave us this precious gift. May we indeed, Lord, enjoy both the beauty and the blessings of the Christian bedroom to the honor and glory of our Savior Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next Wednesday night.